Okay, so sorry about the delay. I'm trying to work out the bugs for next time. Today, Majjhima 54, Pautaliya Sutta, a discourse given to Pautaliya. This particular one has a parallel in Sutta number 203 of the Chinese Majjhima Agama. And in this case, the Chinese version takes place in Parvarika's mango grove near the town of Nalanda, whereas the Pali version has the town Apana in the country of the Anguttarapanas as its location. And in addition, there are, interestingly enough, there's a couple of Sanskrit fragments. Both of the existing Sanskrit fragments correspond to the concluding part of the sutta. And both fragments continue with the beginning part of the Majjhima 26. Okay, so now Majjhima 54, but the Sanskrit fragments have got the ending of this sutta and then continuing with what in Pali is Majjhima 26, which is what? Arya Pariyasana Sutta. But the Arya Pariyasana Sutta is number 204 in the Chinese Majjhima Agama. So the two Sanskrit versions have the same sequence as the Chinese translation. So that's quite interesting. So that's one of the things that we can use to tell that they probably come from the same school or the same, at least closely related, recension of the same text. So this is the two Sanskrit fragments, curiously enough, having fragments of not only the same text, but the same bit of the same text, and also following on with the same bit of the first next text, and that being in the same sequence as the Chinese. So those three probably, or the most likely explanation for that, it would be that they're all from the same school, or at least from schools that had similar versions of the Majjhima Agama. Which is, of course, the Sarvasivans. So, Pautaliya. So, very suitable sutta for today's sutta class. Purely by coincidence. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the country of the Anguttarapanas. A bit clumsy, isn't it? Anguttarapesu. Anguttarapu. It's the water of the Anguttara. The Anguttara water. People living in the Anguttara water district.
Swamp?
Swamp, yeah, it could be. Where there was a town of theirs named Apana. Or maybe it's not water, if it's Apana. I'm not sure what Apana means. Anyway. Then, when it was morning, the Blessed One... I wonder, because you have the Panchab, which is the five waters.
And then become eight.
And if the Anguttarapanas is like the one-up, it's a one-upmanship river place. Our river is better than yours or something like that, I don't know.
Anguttara, isn't that numbered?
Something like that, yeah. So you have like the Panchab, which is the five rivers. So here you have the Anguttarapan, is the one-up rivers. The numbered rivers, something. It's a bit curious. Anyway.
In a place called Panchgani.
Panchgani.
Five table lands. The village was surrounded by
five tables. Then when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe went into Apana for alms. When he wandered for alms in Apana and returned from his alms round, after his meal he went to a certain grove for the day's abiding. Having entered the grove, he sat down at the root of a tree. Pautaliya, the householder, while wandering and walking for exercise, wearing full dress with parasol and sandals. Okay? So, Sampanna Nivasana Nivasana Papurano. Something like that. I don't know what that Papurano. Sampana means fully. Nivasa is dressed. Papurano. I'm not quite sure what that bit means. With walking with parasol and sandals. Okay, the chatta and the upanaha. The sandals. His tevas. And his parasol.
Why is he a Potaliopi?
Potalia, what's his name?
Potalia.
Yeah.
When he becomes Potaliopi.
Well, Patalio is the what form? Potalio is the is the nominative. Thank you very much, Eva. That's very good. Yeah. So, I've been here teaching Pali for 4 years and somebody remembers the most basic grammatical category. That's great. Fantastic. I'm thrilled. Potalio, be, meaning?
Mr. Potalio.
Potalio, be, meaning?
Bro.
Sorry? Roll?
Potalio, bro.
Bro. Nah. That's in Thai. P means brother. Patalio B.
Many Patalio.
B.
B. Was it?
There was a Patalio.
No.
Patalio.
Just being bang on the end.
Yeah. Look at the Chinese.
Don't look at the Chinese to figure out your Pali grammar, mate. Ko, that's emphatic. Ko is emphatic.
Gahapati
means householder. Be means also. Api.
Also?
Also.
Patalia, who is also a householder.
Hmm. And Bhikkhu Bodhi is always, as almost always, very precise. He says, also went to the grove. Patalio, be. And there he translated the also. So the Buddha went into the grove and Patalio B went into the grove. Also went into the grove. Okay. Patalio Pika with his things. And went into the Wanasando. Yena so Wanasando. Tenupasankami.
Is he a Brahmin?
Is he a Brahmin? Well, let's see whether it says household. Yeah, I usually would say
this is not the section in Brahmin about Brahmins.
Mm.
No. So I wonder what the significance of the parasol and sandals are. Is it a sign of wealth or aristocracy?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, certainly the parasol is a bit of a dandy kind of thing, you know. Yeah. You don't want your skin to go dark, you know. And sandals is going to be kind of wussy. Right, walking and wandering for exercise, wearing full dress with parasol and sandals, also went to the grove. And having entered the grove, he went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. And when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he stood at one side. Notice that he didn't sit at one side, he stood like the
devas do.
And?
Monks.
No. Bhikkhunis? Stand at one side?
Did they?
Yeah. And the devas stand at one side? Potalio stands at one side? I don't know why. But there you go, that's what they do. Ekamantang Titang, standing at one side. He said to the Blessed One. That's right, he stood at one side. The Blessed One said to him, there are seats, householder, sit down if you like. Akankasi. Okay, sache akankasi, sache if akankasi. You want to. Nisida. You can sit. When this was said, the householder Potalia thought, the recluse Gotama addresses me as householder. And angry and displeased, he remained silent. Okay. Gahapati vādena. Okay. Gahapati vādena. He calls me Gahapati. Similarity. Kupito anattamano. Tornhia Hosi. So this is a standard phrase to mean angry and displeased. You find that in the Vinaya and many places. Kupitoa Natamanoa.
So he must have been a Brahmin then, right? Because he felt himself superior to a Samana.
Well, we'll see why a little bit later.
Oh, yeah. There's
another reason. There's
another reason, yeah. But one question about standing to the side. Mm. So that is a culturally a sign of respect in the time of the Buddha?
It's hard to say whether it's a sign of greater respect or greater deference.
Well, aren't they the same, deference and respect?
Yeah, well, it depends
which
way is it operating. Does it mean we're being more respectful because we're not sitting in your presence? Or does it mean that we don't feel that we're quite comfortable?
Oh, no, but the one side would be a sign of respect.
Yeah, the one side bit. Again, it's not quite sure what that one side thing means. It seems to mean at a respectful distance.
Oh.
Yeah? Yeah.
Or to one side in case there's somebody behind him who wants to see the Buddha as well.
That could be another explanation, yeah. Okay. Right. Dutiyampi ko bhagava. Okay, and then he said a second time and a third time.
Cool.
Then he said to the Blessed One, Master Gotama, it is neither fitting nor proper that you address me as householder. Okay? Taidang bho Gotama na channang taidang na pati rupang yang mang tuang gahapati varena samudachara siti. He was wiggling his head while he said that. And, Natchanang. Oh, I'm not sure what that word, I'm not familiar with that. Natchanang. Taiyang Nat Pati Rupang. Pati Rupa is a common word meaning suitable or appropriate. Pati Rupa Desava Socha in the Mangala Sutta. Living in a suitable dwelling. And the Buddha replied, Tehi gahapati akara te linga te nimitta yathatang gahapati sati. There you have, householder, the aspects, he translates, aspects, properties, linga, signs or marks, nimitta, signs, okay? So these are the outward signals or signs of being a householder. So obviously his clothes and so on, like that is being referred to. He looks like a householder, probably his haircut and those kinds of things. So these words are quite important in Buddhist philosophy. Akara, linga, nimitta. And these are, as you see here, they are treated as more or less synonyms. And this is quite common in Buddhism. These words, particular words, are treated as synonyms. And useful to notice how they're used. Always useful when you see philosophical words, to notice how they're used in ordinary language concepts, because we build up our abstract and philosophical vocabulary by metaphor, like it's got a metaphorical base on the ordinary language, okay? And so often what happens when we learn Buddhism is we're interested in Buddhist philosophy, so we come in and we learn, well, what does anatta mean? And we learn what does not self mean, but we don't know what the word self means to an Indian in that context and that society. So we try to learn the philosophical concept, but we haven't learnt the basic idea that the philosophy was addressing. And so this is the problem. So always a very good idea to start out with a language, learning and paying attention to the very most concrete basic uses of words. And then from then, you can then extrapolate to the philosophical uses. Ah, it'd be pretty close. Yeah. For all practical purposes, it is, except for a few little idiomatic things here and there. Yeah, it's just a dialectical variation. That's all. It's not significantly different, really.
What does linga?
Well, linga again just means signs or something like that. Yeah.
Aspect or
something. Yeah.
So it means it's a synonym. It means almost the same as nimitta.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Nevertheless, Master Gotama, I have given up all of my works and cut off all my affairs. So my works, the kamanta. Okay, so all my kamanta I've given up. Okay, so this is my ways of making a livelihood. Sabbe vohara translates as affairs. Vohara, quite an interesting word, sometimes meaning communications. Okay, and can also mean something like trading or something like that. So affairs is not a bad translation of it. It's a bit vague. But one place the Buddha says that vohara is the outcome of sanya. Okay? So when we have sanya, we have perception of things, and one of the things that sanya allows us to do is to communicate. Because sanya is like a common or a shared knowing. Okay? We all see a tree, we're all three of us standing next to a tree, we see a different visual image, but we all have an idea in our mind of a tree. And that allows us to use the word tree, and that allows us to communicate the concept of a tree to each other and to talk about it. Okay, so that's one of the uses of the word vohara. But here, again, seems to be a more concrete meaning. He's cut off his livelihood and his job. Basically, he's left his job and his affairs. Okay, Master, in what way, householder, have you given up all your works and cut off all your affairs? Master Gotama, I have given all my wealth, grain, silver and gold to my children as their inheritance. I do not advise or blame them about such matters, but merely live on food and clothing. That is how I have given up all my works and cut off all my affairs. Okay, so my dana, danya, rajatang, jatarupang. Okay, I've given up all of those things. The wealth, the dana, is a general word meaning wealth. Dhanya, meaning grain. Okay, so and these two often combined, you see they're very similar sounding words, although they're actually different meaning, but often combined, the dana, dhanya, and meaning basically your possessions. Radhatang, being the silver, and the jatarupang, being the gold.
Do you think, Bhante, that he sounds a little bit bitter and disappointed about giving all his stuff away to his children because of the way it's put?
Why?
Therefore he might be in a bad mood anyway because of that.
Why do you think he sounds like he's in a bad mood?
Well, because he gets upset when the Buddha calls him a householder. That doesn't seem like a dirty word.
Well, yes, but obviously he feels that he's not a householder anymore. So he's obviously got a bit of pride around the fact that he's given everything up and wants to be recognized as someone who's a renunciate.
A retired person.
More than a retired person, a renunciate. He wants to be seen as a renunciate. Yeah.
And a renunciate would carry a parasol and all that?
Well, that's the point. Exactly. That's why the Buddha calls him a householder. Okay.
So all that would have made him cranky.
Okay. Right. The Buddha said, householder, the cutting off of affairs as you describe it is one thing, but in the Noble One's Vinaya, the cutting off affairs is different. Anyata. One thing, anyata, another thing, anyata, vohara samuchedang pari aryasa vinaya. So the Buddha often referred to his own religion as the Arya Vinaya. Why do you reckon?
Well, the Arya in the sense of the noble one.
Oh yeah, I don't think it meant the Aryans in the sense of the race. The Aryans in the sense of the race is not found in Buddhist texts at all. And it's not at all clear to what degree it's an actual valid concept in any form really. But certainly it's never used in a racial sense in the Buddhist scriptures. Um Right.
That's good to know if you're teaching endurance, isn't it?
Yeah.
But why would he say Arya Vinaya and not Arya Dhammavinaya?
I don't know, but that's just it's an idiom that he uses to refer to his thing. I mean, I guess in this case, he's emphasizing the Vinaya aspect of things.
The conduct aspect.
Yeah, the conduct aspect, yeah.
Because
Potalia
is referring to basic conduct and what he's done rather than the Dhamma aspect of things. So he's approaching him on his own level.
Yeah, yeah. Does that make sense, yeah?
Yes.
He also uses Dhamma Vinaya.
He also uses Dhamma Vinaya?
In the same sutra?
I don't know, elsewhere, like Tathagatasa Vinaya, Tathagatas Vinaya, and many different words he uses. Okay, now, pay attention. Listen closely to what I shall say. Yes, Bhante, Bhattalya, the householder, replied. The Blessed One said this. So even though he was a bit upset, and he's obviously got a bit of pride there, he's ready to listen to the Dhamma, there are 8 things in the Noble One's Vinaya that lead to the cutting off of affairs. What 8? With the support of non-killing of living beings, the killing of living beings is to be abandoned. So the 8 things. Okay, aparnatipatang nisaya aparnatipato pahatabo. So, dependent, nisaya, in killing on the not killing of beings, aparnatipatang, panatipata is to be abandoned. So this is abandoned, and this particular grammatical form means to be abandoned. Okay? So this is a kind of slightly convoluted way of saying it. With the support of taking of only what is not given, the taking what is not given is to be abandoned. With the support of truthful speech, false speech is abandoned. With the support of unmalicious speech, malicious speech is to be abandoned. With the support of Gidhi Lobhang. Okay. With the support of no rapacity and greed. Okay. Agidhi Lobhang. Nisaya Gidhi Lobho Pahatabo. So the rapacity and greed.
He's got rapacious
here. Has he?
Old translation.
Rapacity. Rapacious is an adjective. Yeah,
does that mean the same as greed?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. they're basically synonyms, as Bhikkhu Bodhi's note says that they're synonyms, but sometimes he just uses, again, not to read too much into the English translation, because he's just trying to use a different English word for each Pali word that means greed, and there's a lot of Pali words that mean greed, so once you've used up the main ones for the most common words, like raga and lobha and so on, then you've got to sort of scratch around for the less common ones and end up with things like rapacity, which is a fairly obscure and intense kind of thing, okay? And similarly with the next one. Greed. Yeah? With the support of no spite and scolding. Spite and scolding are to be abandoned. With the support of no anger and irritation. Anger and irritation are to be abandoned. With the support of non-arrogance. Arrogance is to be abandoned. These are the 8 things stated in brief, without being expounded in detail, that lead to the cutting off of affairs in the Noble One's discipline. So this kind of formulation, on one hand, it seems it's very obvious, and it is very obvious, right? That you know, you're using the opposite of particular defilements and problems to abandon them, you know? So it's very, very straightforward like that. But on the other hand, it's not obvious at all, because, you know, like even when just now when we were with the Christian group, and this is what they were saying, is that, you know, basically the difference is we believe that we can't do these things ourselves, so we have to rely on God to do them. So from that perspective, you don't follow this method at all. You rely on God to get rid of all of those 8 factors, yeah? Because I can't do them, yeah? So it's actually, even though, in a sense, yeah, it's so obvious, why does it need stating? But actually, it's very important, and it's another thing, it's saying that it's up to us to develop those things, but it's also saying that there's like specific defilements that have a specific characteristic, and you need to look at them and be able to abandon them. It's not good enough. You can't just get rid of, you know, it's not just like one size fits all, okay? So you can't just, you know, by abandoning greed, well, there's other defilements apart from greed as well, Okay, so you have to look at the individual defilements that are causing dukkha, and be able to abandon them.
Okay, what is angry despair?
Yeah, he translates it different.
Angry despair.
Angry despair. Angry despair is to be abandoned.
Angry despair. Anger and irritation I have here. Here is kodhupayasa. Okay? Kodha, just a word meaning anger. Upayasa, it translates despair. it's a bit... just think of it as another synonym for anger.
So what's this updated translation?
The one here here is...
In feeling, aren't
they? Yeah. Yeah, anger and irritation he has here. Yeah, normally despair is in the Soka Parideva Dhamma 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 Supayasa. It's the last factor in the kind of
grief,
suffering. Yeah, grief, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Oh, what do you do?
Anyway.
Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Now, even in that case, despair is a bit misleading because despair in English means specifically giving up hope. Right? But upayasa is just an intense form, the way it's defined fairly clearly in the suttas, it's just an intense form of grief and sorrow or something like that. It doesn't mean specifically giving up hope. So even in that context it means, but here it seems to be we're taking a word which normally means basically sadness or misery and we're using it to mean anger, which actually parallels the usage of dominasa, which also normally means misery, and sometimes is used in the five nivarana, the five hindrances, as a synonym for anger or ill will. So those two ideas, it seems, are quite similar. Misery or sadness, and also anger or irritation. They're connected.
When a person is standing at the gap,
uh-huh,
in despair.
With the Alsatian running and snapping,
yes,
at his heels trying to,
yes,
save him, yeah?
And then they jump with despair. You understand the despair that,
yeah,
they must be feeling. But where could the anger come?
Again, yeah, here it probably doesn't mean despair really. It probably just think of it as meaning anger. Okay. The despair is really the result of it. Yeah. So somebody who's been nursing a lot of anger and ill will and so on for many years, and it builds up and builds up and they just can't handle it anymore. So then the despair arises. So despair is probably not a really suitable translation.
Despair is a kind of hatred, isn't it?
Yeah. I would think of it as an outcome of the hatred.
You hate the situation in your mind.
Yeah, I would, but
it leads you to depression and despair.
It leads you to depression and despair, yeah. But I would think of that as an outcome. Not the same. But it seems that sometimes it can be treated as similar in Pali.
In Abhidhamma, it's all rooted in hatred.
Yeah, they're connected. Yeah, I mean, it's again in the Abhidhamma, it's clearly separated in terms of dominasa is a feeling, but that feeling comes from or is connected to those
aversion.
Yeah.
Bahadabo means to be abandoned.
To be abandoned. Yeah.
The grammar form is the same with Bahadabha and Bahadabha.
In the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta? Yes, yes. These are all the same grammatical forms. It's called the future passive participle and basically refers to something which should be done in the future, okay? Mm-hmm. Or it should be done. And that form, as a participle is basically when you get a verb and you treat it like a noun, okay? And so here, as a noun, I shouldn't say as a noun. As an adjective, yes, you're quite right. That's exactly right. You get a verb and you treat it like an adjective. And so here, as an adjective, it has to agree with the noun here, adinadanang. So where this one governs it. So this is the governing word here, the noun, and then this agrees with that. So here, when you have, say, kodupayaso, when that ends with a O, then this has to agree with that. So this is why these differ. But otherwise they're the same. Pisanawaja. So this one's feminine, so this has to have a long A to agree with that. Hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Venerable Sir, it would be good if, out of compassion, the Blessed One would expound to me in detail these eight things that lead to the cutting off affairs in the Noble One's Vinaya, which have been stated in brief by the Blessed One without being expounded in detail. Okay, so he wants to hear more about it. And also the interesting thing, of course, about that is he's referring to an inner discipline rather than simply an external one of pretending to be disinterested in what's going on. Okay. There was a dialogue about that once when Arjunyana told me about when he was in Thailand and he went back to Thailand and there was these two fellows there talking to him, and one of them was talking about he had a fellow working for him, and this fellow who was working for him was like kind of really rude and didn't treat him respectfully and so on and so forth, and he was sort of saying, oh, you know, these days people, you know, just don't have gratitude and respect and so on. And then the other fellow who was with Arjunyana said, you know, you should really tell him, you know, it's your duty to train him. And if he's not behaving in the right way, then it's your duty to teach him and to use the proper forms and so on. And the other fellow said, well, no, I just practice equanimity, you know, for myself, I'm just letting go, I will just watch my own mind. And if he just does that way, then that's his problem. And the other fellow says, no, that's wrong. You shouldn't be doing that. You know, it's your job. How can he learn if you don't teach him? And he said, no, I'm not going to, why should I go around teaching him? It's not my job. And so they're sitting there kind of arguing in front of Arjunyana about this thing, and he's just kind of sitting there watching them as this argument's getting more and more heated. And eventually they stop, and they looked at Arjunyana, and they said, well, what do you think, Arjunyana? What should we do? And Arjunyana replied, well, you're both right and you're both wrong. And he said, well, you're right if you want to have equanimity and just watch your own mind, then that's right. If you want to help somebody and train somebody, that's right. But if you want to argue about it, then that's wrong. This is a very good answer.
Solomon, out there is, of course, Solomon.
Yeah, but then sometimes if you try and correct people, they just get even angrier.
Well, that's when you have to. That's when you have to. Yeah, well, that would be unfortunate, wouldn't it? But the Buddha did say, you know, you should criticize that those should be criticized and praise those should be praised.
But then again, when somebody you could correct it, just say nothing.
Yeah.
So giving the silent treatment.
Yeah. Okay. Now, okay, in detail. With the support of non-killing of living beings, the killing of living beings is to be abandoned. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said? Okay, this is this kind of idiom which we find through the suttas. Iti ko panetang wuttang, kinchetang paticha wuttang. Okay, iti, thus, ko, emphasis, pana, bit of grammatical grease, panetang, this is what was said, panetang, that was said, wuttang. Kincha, kin being the question word, kincha, here being understood as an cha, as an and, kin cha etang paticha, dependent on what? Okay, so the word paticha, as in paticha samuppada, dependent on what was that said? Okay, so here meaning dependent on, but sort of meaning something like with reference to what, or what was that about? Okay, here. A noble disciple considers thus, I'm practicing the way for the abandoning and cutting off of those fetters because of which I might kill living beings. If I were to kill living beings, I should blame myself for doing so. The wise, having investigated, would censure me for doing so, and on the dissolution of the body after death because of killing living beings, an unhappy destination would be expected. But this killing of living beings is itself a fetter and a hindrance, and while taints, vexation and fever might arise through the killing of living beings, there are no taints, vexation and fever for one who abstains from killing living beings. So it was with reference to this that it was said, with the support of the non-killing of living beings, the killing of living beings is to be abandoned. Okay? So that's quite a nice little section there, quite a nice reflection on the keeping of the precepts. And rather than just keeping the precepts mindlessly or not understanding why you're keeping the precepts, then one is actually reflecting on them. And so this is like the difference between, again, this is the internalizing of the practice. It's not merely just doing the non-killing, but also reflecting on why. Okay, so one reason being, and the whole context being to abandoning the fetters which are causing the killing of living beings. Okay, so you're actually working to abandon those defilements in oneself, which causes one to wish harm upon other beings. So if one were to kill, one would blame oneself, one would be blamed by others. Otherwise, after death, you would go to a bad place. Okay, there's three reasons. Also, killing of living beings in itself is a fetter and a hindrance, so it's a defilement in itself. And so because one would have, it says, taints, fixation and fever, that means remorse and sorrow and so on arise if you've killed other beings. So if you don't kill them, then that pain and so on might arise. So it's five good reasons for not killing.
So not killing makes the not killing grow better.
Mm. Yeah.
Is it a kind of a, like, is this an advice to follow this framework?
I think so. Yeah.
Because when you're angry, you don't necessarily have the mental capacity to reflect. Think of five reasons not to do what you're about to do.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can make yourself. Right. If I was to do this, I would criticize myself. The wise would blame me. It's itself, it's a defilement. It's going to leave me to a bad place after death. And bugger it, I'm going to do it anyway.
One of the very nice passages, I think, is that it talks about if you keep the precept of killing, then you're actually giving the gift of fearlessness to other living beings.
Holding your precepts is a gift to other people. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. So there are many ways of reflecting on the precepts, and these are only some of them. But I think that the main thing is if one tries and practices and can reflect on it coolly with a bit of space around one, then when the time comes, when in the heat of the moment, you're more able to respond appropriately. Sorry?
To overcome the heat. What if you don't kill, you don't kill, you don't kill, and years are passing, and then suddenly, you know, one of those passionate ones happens? Out of the blue.
Oh, a crime of passion?
Yes.
Like Chainsaw Massacre.
Chainsaw. You just kill one person. You can't help it.
Uh-huh.
Only one.
Yeah, no, it's hard, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think. Well, remember here what it says is you're practicing for the cutting off of the fetters that are underlying that behaviour. Okay, and I think it's very important that if you're not doing it, okay, you can in a way get complacent about it. You know. But you need to keep on reinforcing that, okay? And to realize, no, it's not just good enough for me to take a precept and not kill, but actually to work on cutting off those fetters that are going to lead to me to the potential to kill in the future. Because absolutely for certain, if you don't cut off those fetters, you will kill in the future. You know, even if it's not in this lifetime, in future lifetimes or whatever. You know, if you keep on going, you're going to be, you know, in that situation. It'll help.
If you see the effects, if you contemplate or reflect on what the effects would be, then you know the danger in it.
Yeah. No, it's very, very important.
It seems terribly dangerous to. I haven't killed anyone or anything, but what if I suddenly kill someone tomorrow? Well, because I killed someone in a previous life or something like that.
Does it refer only to humans or also to animals?
To animals as well, yeah.
So probably we've all killed insects.
Of course,
in our
yeah.
lives.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes it may seem very minor.
Yeah.
The mosquitoes biting you
yeah.
or an ant's walking on you or maybe 10 ants are walking on you, or fire ants are biting your ankles and feet. And you start, get rid of them, and you're not careful.
Yeah.
Then, it may not be out of extreme anger, but you're irritated.
Yes.
You're upset. You're in pain.
and so
you want to get rid of it, and you're not sensitive to the fact that this is a living being.
Yeah.
So.
I was worried about that when I had this red ant chewing my brain. You know, and there's this kind of thing that's crawled inside my head and it's in there eating my brain. And
this is a dream?
No, this was an ant. And,
are you serious?
Yeah. It's been, you know, the big biting red ants crawled in my ear.
Oh, it crawled into your ear?
Yeah.
Oh my
God. Yeah, that's what the doctor said. Yeah.
When he saw it?
The doctor looked in this funny thing and he said, "Oh my God." but yeah, and you know, went in, and of course, trying to get it out. I mean, you can't get it out without killing it. Well, that would kill it. Yeah. Yeah, that would have been one way of getting it out. Yeah. Yes. Put a bit of honey on the outside of your ear. That's what I've heard people have said that as well.
What did they do to you?
Well, first of all, I was just staying in this cave by myself in Ipoh, so I just like panicked. First thing I do is completely lose all my mindfulness and panic, and that's the first reaction. Second reaction is to go over the road and there's this Chinese restaurant where they all just speak Chinese there, you know, and I'm like, and and then one of them went over to their car or something and they got this kind of oil thing and they put it in there. And that slowed it down a bit. And then I went, well, it's still biting me. And then they took me into the... I was just sitting there chewing it. It was incredibly painful. And they took me over to a doctor, a nearby doctor. I'm just sitting in the waiting room. And someone's waiting. There's like three ladies in front of me waiting to fill their prescriptions up. And I'm like, oh, no. I was like, man, eating my head, you know, chewing my brain up. Oh, yes, if you just wait your turn, sir. So eventually I get in there and he shines his thing and says, oh, my God. Yes, that's what I've been trying to say for some time. And then he tried to get it out and couldn't. But he killed it in the process. And... gave me some antibiotics. He couldn't get it out. I had to go to a specialist and suck it out a few weeks later. Had to wait because it was all cut up. Yeah, because it was all cut up and inflamed and so on, so they couldn't get the things in there to pull it out.
Could it bite your eardrum?
Yeah, look, it didn't do any serious damage, but it certainly bit a lot in there. And those, you know, the big red ants, I mean, they're pretty...
Yeah, that could have gone through your eardrum.
Yeah, it could have done some serious stuff.
He doesn't mention anything about practicing method here.
Right, so that's all right.
I mean, that's another way of saying it. I mean, I suppose it's not easy to be sending method to an ant while it's biting your ear.
Yeah, it's true. It's true, yeah.
But that's what the Buddha taught. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
He certainly taught us to do that, even if somebody's cutting off your arms and legs.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not necessarily an easy practice.
No, it's not.
But I did have one question about karma.
Yeah.
If he's saying that it's a fetter,
uh-huh.
So and you're trying to get rid of this fetter, so that if you actually kill a living being, then there's these five ways, but I'm trying to understand how it works in terms of karma. That one of the ways is like an immediate, I don't know if you can call it karma, but the fact is you increase the fetter. If you kill a living being, then you're strengthening that fetter.
Yep.
So would that be karma?
Yeah, sure, of course. Yeah.
But also you're creating future karma, a rebirth in a painful realm.
Well, the future, you're creating future vipaka. Future result, yeah. But the act at that time is the karma.
So that's not a karmic result.
The act.
No, the fact that your mind becomes more defiled.
No. Yeah, that's not a karmic result. That's the karma at that moment.
Would you call it karmic tendency?
I'll just call
say
it
that karma. Through strengthening that karmic tendency.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, and then the reflection in a similar way for each of the other precepts. So these are not, this kind of reflection is not an individual one, it's a general one for each to be applied to each of those factors. Okay. Now these eight things lead to the cutting off of affairs in the Noble One's vinaya. But, says the Buddha, you've already done here. But na tueva tava ariyasa vinaya sabena sabbang sabata sabbang vohara samuchedo hoti. But it is not to that extent, na tueva tava, to that extent, ariyasa vinaya sabena sabbang sabata sabbang. So sabba means all, okay? And so this kind of idiom, sabbena sabbang, sabbata sabbang, is really just an idiom in Pali meaning very emphatically, all in every way, completely, totally. Okay? And so that's a very emphatic idiom, that there's a complete and total final cutting off of the affairs. And Potali, of course, takes the bait and says, well, how is there the final cutting off of all affairs, complete cutting off of all affairs in the Noble One's vinaya? It would be good if the Blessed One would teach me these things. Listen, householder, and attend closely to what I would say. Yes, Venerable Sir. Householder, suppose a dog... So we had some questions about this yesterday. So the word for dog, kukuro. So this is one of the...
Oh, that was a chicken.
No, it's kukuta, kukuro. There's a few different words for dog, but there's one of them, kukuro. Okay? Overcome by hunger and weakness, was waiting by a butcher's shop, jigacha dubalya. So jigacha, hunger and weakness. Oh, sorry, hunger and jigacha is the hunger. Dubalya, bala is the strength. Dubalya is the weakness. Okay? Dubala, unstrong. And the ya is the abstract noun ending. So that's the ness. So not strongness, literally, or weakness. Okay. Was standing outside a go ghataka. Okay, so the go is the cow. Okay. This is cognate with the English word go. English word cow, not the English word go. Ghata is to kill.
Cow killing place,
exactly. Then a skilled butcher, dakko go ghatako, or a butcher's apprentice, go ghatakante vasi. So notice that the same word antevasi, here used to mean apprentice, as also used in the vinaya. So butcher's apprentice. Would toss the dog a clean hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood. Okay, atika. So atika is the skeleton. Atikankalam. And this must be the hacked sunikanta. Nikanta. Okay, so well hacked. Nimmangsang. Mangsa is the meat, flesh. Mangsa. And nimmangsa. No meat, fleshless. So this is the, to use it, one of Eva's favourite words, the defleshed skeleton.
Oh yes, very difficult, the professor said.
Yes.
So that's why he's a skilled butcher.
That's why he's a skilled butcher, or a skilled butcher's apprentice. Lohita makitang, okay? So lohita is the blood. Makitang is smeared, okay? Upachubheya. Chucked it out, all right? What do you think, householder? Would that dog get rid of his hunger and weakness by gnawing such a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood? No, Venerable Sirs. Why is that? Because that was a skeleton of well-hacked, clean-hacked meatless bones smeared with blood. Eventually, that dog would reach weariness, would reap weariness and disappointment. Okay? So, is the weariness and disappointment is the... So kukuro kilamata as in the Atta Kilamatana Yoga in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Kilamata, the weariness, wearying oneself. So here he would be weariness and vighata, disappointment. Okay. So literally, he would have a share. He would have asa a bhagi. He would be a sharer of weariness and disappointment, is the literal translation. Thus, so too, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a skeleton by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Having seen this thus as it actually is, with proper wisdom, he avoids the equanimity that is diversified based on diversity and develops the equanimity that is unified based on unity, where clinging to the material things of the world utterly ceases without remainder. So this, of course, being a very interesting and suggestive little passage here. So evmetang yathabhutang samapanyaya diswa, so having seen thus in accordance with the truth, in accordance with conditions, or whatever you want to translate that, so that means he's an Arya, he's a noble one, as it says here, he's an Arya Savaka, up here above somewhere, Arya Savaka, so he's at least a stream enterer. So he's not relying on the equanimity, the upekha, which is based on nanatta. So nanatta meaning diversity, manyfoldness. Right?
Why is that a bad thing?
What do you reckon?
Well, equanimity for everything and everyone is a good thing, isn't it?
What do you think it means here about the equanimity based on manyfold? What do you think it means?
I don't know.
I think it has to do with meditation and that
equanimity,
the diversified one is you know, you can have equanimity based on your experience of what's happening, but the equanimity that you should be developing is that which is in the meditation, and that's unified, whereas in the sensual realm is diversified because you've got the five senses.
Yeah.
So you hit with all these things, but you can be equanimous with them, but that's not the kind of equanimity you would develop in the fourth jhana.
Yep.
Is that right?
Something like that, yeah. And the upekha ekatta, obviously the unified being referring to a samadhi experience. Ekagata, yeah. But also referring back to Potali's original statement where he said he's got rid of all his affairs and he sort of, you know, he doesn't instruct his children when they want to do this or do that. He's just looking at them all with equanimity. And so he's saying, oh, I'm looking at all of these things. But it's actually all this worldly stuff that's going on which he's looking at with equanimity. So in a sense, I think what the Buddha's saying is, he's not necessarily saying that that's wrong, but he's saying this is not the full cutting off affairs in each and every way. So if you really want to cut off affairs in each and every way, then you have to develop this equanimity based on unification, which obviously is referring to the fourth jhana. Yatta sabbaso lokamisu padana aparisesa nirujhanti, wherein all kinds of worldly amisa stuff, grasping at worldly stuff, ceases without remainder. Okay, so obviously based on the fourth jhana, then one gets rid of one's attachment to everything in the world. Okay,
is it right that it's talking about unified equanimity? So that means just one thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So if you just look with equanimity at your house,
in fourth jhana. Talking about fourth jhana.
And what does that mean with equanimity?
Well, the equanimity, we've already gone through the four jhanas.
Equanimity. Serious equanimity.
Equanimity itself.
Yep.
And what is the thing that makes that arise?
The
first three jhanas.
And then you have this equanimity. You become equanimity.
Or you become equanimous.
Your mind becomes full of it. Yeah.
Well, that sounds diversified, doesn't it? Like full of it. For everything.
No, you're in a state of samadhi either. So your mind's only aware of one thing, which is your meditation nimitta. Okay? So you've got a bright light in your mind, bright like the sun, and you're completely equanimous about it. The mind has no. This is the equanimity based on this is the equanimity based on unification, which this is talking about. Yeah?
That's not such an easy thing.
It is not such an easy thing. No.
Could you repeat that last phrase there? Yata, sabbaso.
Yata, wherein.
Wherein.
Uh-huh. Sabbaso, all kinds of.
Yeah.
Loka, worldly.
Mm-hmm.
Amisa means stuff.
Things.
Something like that. Upadana, grasping. Okay, so grasping at worldly things, grasping at the stuff of the world. Aparisesa, completely ceases. Okay.
Oh, before I think you said without remainder.
Oh, without remainder, yeah, that's another way of putting it. Without remainder is probably better. Aparisesa ceases without remainder.
Well, because I've read a similar phrase when the five khandhas cease without remainder.
Yeah.
And also when there's two types of arahantship. The first one is when all defilements cease without remainder.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the second one, of course, is parinibbana, when the five khandhas cease without remainder. But here, if they cease without remainder, they completely cease, all kinds of attachments cease. Mm. Would that be referring to arahantship then?
Yep.
Because it's already a noble disciple.
He's well, a noble disciple is not necessarily an arahant.
But he's a noble disciple when he's starting this practice. And remember, the Buddha.
So this is the goal then.
The Buddha said, started out saying, this is how there's a complete cutting off of affairs in each, every completely total final way.
Ah,
yeah?
Okay, so he's showing the final goal here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is arahantship.
Yeah, yeah. Even though it's expressed in a somewhat cryptic and shortened way,
okay.
But it's clear from the context that must be what he means, yeah? Because he's very emphatically said, you know, total, final, complete, everything, yeah? This little phrase at the end here is a bit intriguing. Tame upekhang tam eva. Just that is upekha. He develops upekha. Something like that. I'm not sure how Bhikkhu Bodhi's translated that. The Bhikkhu Bodhi doesn't seem to quite actually translate that phrase.
Perhaps he's used another.
Maybe in another reading, yeah.
He makes this, he's on the Burmese, maybe he slipped up and didn't check the sinula this time.
Yeah, it's hard to say. Okay. Now, householder, suppose a vulture, a heron or a hawk, gijho, a vulture, heron, a gunko, or a hawk, kulalo. Okay. Sees
crow.
Yeah, it says here is a kulalo. It's not a. Pali is not a crow. A crow is kaka in Pali. That's an easy one to remember.
Because the crows go.
Kaka. Easy. While mangsa piercing, okay, is a piece of meat, a piece of mangsa, adaya. Okay. Way to go to and fly away, urdiyeya. Now then vultures, herons, and hawks pursued it. I think actually the thing about the crow might be that it might be the simile appears elsewhere, and it might use crow elsewhere in the simile, which I think would make more sense, but he's probably maybe copied it over, but the actual text here has these ones. Now then the vultures, herons and hawks pursued it and pecked it and clawed it. What do you think, household? If that vulture, heron or hawk does not quickly let go of the piece of meat, wouldn't it incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Okay, monks are piercing that. Kippameva patinisajaya. Kippameva. Right away. Get rid of it. Just get rid of it straight away. So, in the same way, the noble disciple considers thus. Oh, hang on, I missed. I've got that. Essential pleasures have been compared with a piece of meat by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Having seen thus, he with proper wisdom, and so on. So, And again, the word for despair, bahu dukkha, bahu upayasa. So the same word for despair, upayasa, we saw above. And so here it seems to mean suffering, mental suffering, misery, whereas before it meant anger, something like that.
The key word in this one is let go. You mm-hmm. see what I mean? Because you have like these other people, in a way, because they're other people chasing after you and trying to get that which is yours, but you're holding on to it, and that's what's causing the suffering. But once you let go of it, then there's no longer that suffering.
Yeah.
And I think the simile before is that, well, chewing on a bone is not going to give you any satisfaction when you're hungry.
Yeah.
So in the same way, it's like sensual pleasures is like chewing on a bone that
doesn't give you what you want. Yeah.
So I think these similes are really
very well chosen. Yeah. Very, very, very precise.
But there are sensual pleasures which are pleasant and not ugly, not unwholesome. Mm. On a hot day, you leap into your pool. It's very pleasant, but it's not wrong.
It's not wrong.
Why is it wrong?
Didn't say it was wrong.
No one's saying it's wrong. Jump in a pool if you like. I don't care.
No, well, it's a sensual pleasure.
It is a sensual pleasure.
You feel the cool water.
It is, yeah. Nice. Yeah. And then if you're attached to that, you get to come back again in the next lifetime and have another pool.
Become a fish.
It can become a fish. Why is it nice?
Because your skin's hot. And
right, it's because you're suffering. Yeah. If you're not suffering in the first place, then jumping in the pool is not nice. That's why Australians like swimming pools and English people don't.
People jump into the pool when they don't have to be suffering.
Yeah, you do. Otherwise, why would you jump in the pool?
To have a swim.
But these things are always based on some kind of dualism. Yeah. So the food tastes good because of hunger. Swimming in the pool is nice because of heat and all these kinds of things. So you're actually like relieving something. Yeah. So even though in itself, of course, there's nothing evil or wrong about going for a swim in the pool, but you have to recognize that if you're attached to that, then that's what binds us onto the round of samsara. And we think it's very innocuous. Okay. And that's really the whole message of this sutta is Potalia, thinks he's given everything up. And really, he's just he's still attached, obviously, to his nice clothes and to his nice umbrella and all of these kinds of things. And so he thinks that just doing what he's done is already enough to give all these things up. And Buddha's saying, no, actually, if you're still involved with those things, you don't give it up completely, then you're still going to be bound up with suffering in the future, even if you might feel that it's perfectly okay now.
Well, what about a gold medalist in the Olympics who swims every day mm-hmm. 6 hours, mm-hmm. and that's what he does?
Mm-hmm. He or she?
Well,
this one happens to be a bloke, that's right.
Yeah, but then again, you only jump into the pool because you're suffering. But if you stayed in the pool 24 hours, or 36 hours, would you still be happy?
Well, no
doubt. You get the wrinkly skin.
So you'd have to get out again because that also leads to suffering if you stay there.
Yeah, but if you're...
So you're constantly going from one, trying to avoid suffering from one state to another, but you keep getting driven. It's just inherent suffering.
That's very abstract, though.
Well, it's like if you sit on the most comfortable chair, it's really comfortable, but you stay there for a whole day, you're going to be in agony.
No. Sitting's lovely.
Because you still have to move.
You still have to move. Yeah. Same with food, you can have the most lovely piece of food or whatever. The first one tastes really good, the second one tastes a little bit not quite as good, the third one not quite as good again, and by the time you get your fourth one, you don't really want anymore, and then if you have a fifth one, you're starting to feel sick, and the seventh one, you're starting to vomit. Yeah.
Watermelon on a hot day can't
be bad. It's like you eat because you're hungry and
it's pleasant, but then you keep eating and something else. It's not hunger and it's not pleasant. It's not the same story anymore. So you can't really logically justify
one. No, but it's just pointing out that it's all but it's based on the dualism, yeah? So then that dualism is always based on a search. So once you satisfy one need, then you have to satisfy the next need. And so on and so forth. So there's this constant struggle to find something, find some way of satisfying something.
Yeah,
maybe they're actually talking about the naughty sensual pleasures.
I don't think so.
No, it's much broader than that, even.
I think that if you see from the Buddhist point of view, you see that we're born into a realm where we have a body. And this body has various requirements, and all our lives, because we have this body, we're born with this body as a result of our past karma, all our lives are spent trying to satisfy the desires of this body. So we think, oh, eating is so wonderful. But when you get to be 61 years old, or 70 years old, or 80 years old, a time may come when you think, my God, I'm really tired of having to eat all the time. Every day I have to eat. And then I get diarrhea, I get sick, I get this problem, I get that problem. So so then you begin to see things from a broader perspective, not just from this. I mean, these are just some examples. But if you compound these examples and you look at it lifetime after lifetime of having this body, of having to deal with all the needs and pleasures and desires of this body, which sometimes are very opposed to what other people will want, you know, and cause other people suffering, then you see what a vast mass of dukkha it is. But that takes a kind of a broad, very comprehensive view of things that most people, they don't see that.
Yeah.
What about like the kind of Zen enlightenment where you're just like you're hungry and you're eating, starving, and sleep, and simple? You don't have to worry about the compounding problem.
Yeah, well, that's all right. I mean, that's what you do. Yeah, but you do it because you need to. Yeah. So just because you're enlightened, you don't stop eating. But you know, you don't. You know, there are certain things which are not necessary, so if you're enlightened, then you don't do those things that are not necessary. But those things that are necessary, you keep on doing them, but without getting caught up in them and identifying with them.
But that Zen thing is more talking about living in the present moment, isn't it? It's like a
vipassana thing, just eating. Eat. When you eat, when you're hungry, eat. When you're thirsty, drink. When you're tired, drink coffee. My Zen Roshi, astrologer, he taught me that. It's not my Zen Roshi, it's my friend. Okay, so, but anyway, if you don't agree with what the Buddha said about sensual pleasures, then just go for it. Yeah, just go for it. Indulge.
It actually
see what happens.
Material.
Uh-huh, sorry?
Clinging to the material things.
Ah, Misa. Yeah.
It's actually brought it in.
Yeah, amisa being like sight, sound, smell, taste and touches.
The whole of the five senses, the whole experience.
All right.
I guess it's best to be ordained.
Well, so let's have a look at some more of these similes and see what they have to say to us. Householder, suppose a man took a blazing grass torch. Aritang tinukkang. Okay, so aritang, the blazing. And went against the wind. Pati vatang. So the vata is the wind. Pati against the wind. What do you think, householder? If that man does not quickly let go of that blazing grass torch, wouldn't that blazing grass torch burn his hand or his arm or some other part of his body so that he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Seems a little bit extreme, I have to admit. I don't think you'd probably go, ow. But I don't know if you'd die from being burnt by a blazing grass torch. But anyway, the point is well taken. Okay, so again, this kind of thing, and with all of these, it's something which is, you know, it's useful, a blazing grass torch is okay, but you know, if you're grasping it and using it in the wrong way, then you get hurt. And so, yeah?
Okay, just in terms of the conversation we were having before, I think what he's trying to show is that, I mean, if you believe that the cessation of suffering is the goal, and in another sutta, he says that you cannot engage in sensual pleasures without arousing the mind of sensual desire.
Yeah.
So every time we engage in one of these practices, aren't we, in a sense, we're strengthening that attachment, that clinging. We're strengthening our craving. Mm. And so if you really believe the Buddha's teachings, then that will inevitably result in more suffering. Mm. Maybe it's not going to be so immediate as yeah. that. Right. Maybe somebody is going to jump in the swimming pool every day,
mm.
you know, and feel good and so forth. And mm. in some ways, it can be beneficial if one does it strictly for health.
Mm.
But if craving and attachment arises, mm. then in the long run, it's preventing our enlightenment.
Mm.
It's preventing us from progressing yeah. on the path if we're still clinging to these physical sense pleasures.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, anyways, it's just another perspective I was wanting to bring.
Okay, so grass torch. Then the next one. Householder, suppose there were a charcoal pit deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals without flame or smoke. Then a man came who wanted to live and not to die, who wanted pleasure and recoiled from pain. And two strong men seized him by both arms and dragged him towards that charcoal pit. What do you think, householder? Would that man twist his body this way and that? So it's a kind of slightly wimpy translation at the end there. I think you'd probably do more than twist your body this way and that in that kind of case. Scream and struggle, perhaps. Yes, Venerable Sir. Why is that? Because that man knows that if he falls into that charcoal pit, he will incur death or deadly suffering. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers our sensual pleasures have been compared with a charcoal pit by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and despair, while the danger in them is great. So a little bit of a variation here, according to the up until now, these two versions are pretty much the same, and the similes are all the same, but this particular simile is treated a little bit differently in both ones. The Chinese version doesn't mention about the two men dragging you into the Chinese pit, sorry, into the burning pit. They only talk about the a man who doesn't want to die and he doesn't want to fall into the burning pit, and because he wants to avoid suffering and experience happiness. And the Venerable Nalo gives some kind of discussion that which basically he concludes that the Chinese version seems a little bit more plausible here. The idea that the two men are grabbing you by the hands and throwing you in the pit is elsewhere used to describe karma or jetana. So it's the effect of jetana, is like the force that's bringing you to them. Here, in this context, we're just trying to illustrate the pain of sensual pleasure, so bringing in the two men dragging you into the pit is not necessarily relevant. But actually, you know, what's relevant is the actual pain itself. So, so Analo gives a few discussions of different versions of that. Okay, next one. Householder, suppose a man dreamt of lovely parks. Okay, so the man supina kang. So in a dream, supina. Paseya, he would see. So he would see in a dream, arama, aramaneyakam, delightful aramas, delightful vanas, delightful bhumis, delightful pokaranis. Okay? So delightful parks, groves, meadows, and lakes. On waking, he saw nothing of it. So to the householder. Okay, so patibuddho nakinchi paseya. He didn't see anything. Patibuddho. So notice the word buddha used literally here in its literal sense of awakening. So and then the same sensual pleasures have been compared with a dream by the Blessed One. So suppose a man borrowed goods on loan, a fancy carriage and fine jeweled earrings. Okay? So suppose a man yachitikan, bogan yachitwa, on loan, got a fancy carriage, yana, borosayang, and then the fine jeweled earrings, pavara mani kundalang. Pavara is the excellent mani jeweled kundala, is the earrings. And he proceeded, and surrounded by these borrowed goods, he went to a marketplace. Okay, then people seeing him would say, "Sirs, that is a rich man. That is how the rich enjoy their wealth." Then the owners, whenever they saw him, would take back their things. What do you think, householder? Would that be enough for that man to become dejected? Yes, Bhante, why is that? Because the owners took back their things.
This one I slightly can't get dejected, so it's not respected, or?
No, just sad. He would be, you know, he's got these things, he feels really good because he's got his cool earrings on or whatever. He's got his Monaro, his fancy vehicle. He's got his Monaro, he's got his bling, right? He's got his wheels, he's got his bling.
What's a bling?
What's bling? Does somebody want to explain what bling is?
You've been out of America for a while.
Yeah.
I never heard.
Bling, basically it's just a trendy word for jewellery.
That's the hip hop word for jewellery.
Yeah. That's where you've got a big chunky kind of diamond things and stuff and you show off your wealth.
Yeah,
diamonds in your teeth. So you got
it's
your.
If it was alive now, the Buddha would say it's like, you know, you get your credit card, you go down, you buy your car with $5.
That's right.
Then
you get your bill.
You buy your bling, you buy things.
Don't keep up your payments and they come and repossess it.
Exactly. I mean, and it hasn't changed very much, has it, really? I mean, this is exactly the same thing people spend their money on, a nice set of wheels,
yeah.
And their bling. I mean. You know, and starting off down at the whatever, the rave party or whatever. And then they take it back and then you're like, oh, you know, and then you don't want to, you're even worse off than you were before, because now if you, you know, when you go down there again and everyone says, you know, yeah, I'm on the bus today. So, but that's also very lovely. I think it's a wonderful simile, you know, just like it's borrowed goods. You just take it, you use it for a time and then it's gone. It's like, well, that's it.
So he's actually enjoying himself for a while.
Yeah.
But then later on, you have to pay the price.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that the difference, like some of them, you know, like the charcoal pit and so on, are pretty violent ones. I mean, the charcoal pit is more normally used as a synonym for hell. You know, so it's a bit intense to be put right in that context. But these other ones are a bit more gentle, but still they really get the point across, you know, like a vanished dream. Okay. Now, suppose there were a dense grove. Okay. A tibbo wanasando, dense grove, near, not far from some village or town, within which there was a tree laden with fruit, but none of the fruit had fallen to the ground. Okay. Sampanna palo, endowed with fruit. Then a man came needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit. And he, so wandering in search of fruit, is the palatiko, wanting fruit, atta, the word atta, is the wanting here. His goal was fruit, palatiko. Palagavesi, so a fruit cow seeker. Pariesanang, so pariesa here, the same root as gavesi, okay? And this being an example of the what syllables principle?
Seeking
waxing syllables principle. Thank you very much. Right? The waxing syllables principle being the principle in Pali syntax that. Someone care to define the waxing syllables principle?
Gets bigger and bigger.
Gets bigger and bigger. Things tend to get bigger. Whether words, phrases, and so on, when they're in a list like that, very often the short ones at the beginning, and then they get longer and longer as they go on, being a stylistic feature of Pali prose. Right. Okay, then he thought, this tree is laden with fruit, but none of it's fallen to the ground. I know how to climb a tree, so let me climb this tree, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag. And he did so. Then a second man came needing fruit, and taking a sharp axe, he entered the grove and saw that tree laden with fruit. I mean, this is working up like a kind of a Roadrunner cartoon or something like that. we know what's going to happen, you know. Everybody thought, this tree is laden with fruit, but none of the fruit's fallen to the ground. I don't know how to climb a tree. So, why don't I just cut the tree down at the root, eat as much fruit as I want, fill my bag. And he did so. What do you think, householder? If that first man who'd climbed the tree doesn't come down quickly when the tree falls, wouldn't he break his hand or his foot or some other part of his body so that he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? So too, householder, a noble disciple considers our sensual pleasures have been compared with fruits on a tree by the Blessed One. Okay, so this is
so it would be a modern day one of this.
Modern day one of the fruits on the tree. I don't know. Can't think of an example off the top of my head. I'm not as good at thinking.
Sort of that chatting on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
On some kind of messaging thing.
Mm-hmm.
You really just want to keep chatting, but there's an electrical storm, and then get zapped, and then you get zapped. It's a bit convoluted.
Yeah, it's not particularly poetic, I have to admit. Yeah. Yeah, it was like maybe you're swimming, and somebody just drains the pool while you're in there. And there you are on the bottom of the pool going like this, thinking, oh, this swimming's no fun anymore.
No, you just keep swimming, the water's going out, you're not trying to get out.
Well, you're going to dive in and all the water's going out.
That's another possibility.
But there's one there, though, that he dreams about a park.
Mm.
And then he wakes up.
Yeah.
And he's sad because
they're not there.
When he wakes up, it's not there.
Yeah.
So that's one where he doesn't experience some painful karmic result.
Mm.
It's just like the three kinds of suffering, the Viparinama, no.
Viparinama dukkha?
Viparinama dukkha. Isn't that similar to Viparinama dukkha?
Yeah.
Somebody's experiencing something which they're really enjoying, and then it's not like they suffer afterwards, but that enjoyment is no longer there.
Yeah,
that's the second kind of suffering.
Yeah.
It's coming in contact with a mental object.
Yeah.
Because it's not there, the painful suffering arises. This is very kind of dependent origination. Different examples.
Yeah.
It's from the very gross to the very subtle.
Yeah. But it is like that sometimes, you know, things with a dream. Like if you think when you're kind of young and wild, or you think you're wild, and you sort of go out and you drink and kind of do all this kind of stuff, and then the next morning you wake up, you know, and that's what it's like. You look back and you think, God, what happened? And it's these kind of confused, vague memories of what happened last night, and then you talk to your friends and they tell you all the things you did. I don't know, I've had that experience. Okay. So then, talking about sakoso gahapati aryasavako iman yeva, that very yeva, very iman yeva anuttarang upekha sati parisuddhihin. Okay. So here, making clear what we mentioned before, that he's speaking up to the upekha ekata. He's talking about fourth jhana. So here, making that more explicit, anuttarang upekha sati parisuddhihin, of course, being one of the classic phrases found in the formula for the fourth jhana, the purification of mindfulness based on equanimity, or however you want to say that. And unexcelled, agama anekavihitang pubinivasang anusarati. So he recollects his various past dwellings. one birth, two births, and so on and so forth, through the recollection of past lives. And then the Divena Chakuna Visudhena Atikantamanusakena, with the divine eye that's purified and surpasses the human, one sees beings passing away and reappearing, inferior, superior, fair and ugly, in good and bad destinies, and beings reborn according to their karma. So the divine eye, so of course it's talking about the Tevija, the threefold knowledge. Dibba Chakku, which is, where is it? Here it's dib. It's not, here the compound is resolved, so it's Dibbena Chakuna, with the divine eye, but just in a straight noun form you just say Dibba Chakku. Chakku is the eye, yeah. Dibba is the adjective form of Deva, so it's related to English divine. Literally is divine eye. Although actually it's also, etymologically, Dibba and divine is related, but it's also exactly the same meaning as the English word clairvoyance, because the root Dib, or Div, originally means basically clear or bright. So, and that's why it's also the word for day. So the word day is from the same root, so the clear time or the bright time. So clairvoyance means clear vision, so it's actually very similar meaning. And then based on that same unexcelled purity of mindfulness and equanimity, one realizes the ending of all defilements, asavanam kaya, with the ending of defilements, and asavang, the undefiled, cheta vimuting, release of heart, banya vimuting, release by wisdom, dittheva dhamme, in this very life, sayang abhinya, with one's own direct knowledge, sati katva, having witnessed upasampadya viharati, one enters and dwells in it.
What's upasampadya?
Upasampadya enters.
Like ordination, upasampadya?
Yes, it's on a form of saying upasampadya. So, etavata, to this extent, a householder in the noble's one's vinaya, there is a sabbena sabbang sabbata sabbang, a completely, finally, totally, in every possible way, utterly,
completely.
Everything, completely, all, everything, all, is cutting off of affairs. What do you think, Dankin Manyasi Gahapati? What do you reckon, Gahapati? That that such a complete cutting off affairs in all and every way has been achieved. Do you see in yourself? Okay, a complete cutting off affairs in all every way. Atani samanupasati, in yourself. Atani. Do you, api nu tuang, do you, in yourself, so here's atani, the locative form, see that. So again, remember I mentioned a bit earlier about how it's useful to see the everyday language versions of philosophical terms. So here we have the word atta, a very common philosophical term used in an everyday sense. Do you see in yourself that thing? So here, not obviously meaning in a metaphysical self sense, but just an everyday language version. And Pātāya replies, Venerable Sir, who am I that I should possess any cutting off of affairs entirely and in all ways like that in the Noble One's vinaya? Okay, so who am I? Ko chāhaṁ, who am I? Bhante. I am far indeed, Venerable Sir, from that cutting off of affairs in the Noble One's vinaya when it has been achieved entirely and in all ways. Okay. I am far. Doesn't seem to have that. Seems to be that's an extra passage. Here it just says, "Who am I in that noble vineyard?" Seems to be an extra sentence in the version that Bhikkhu Bodhi was translating. I am far indeed from that cutting off of affairs and noble one's discipline when it has been achieved entirely and in all ways. For Venerable Sir, though the wanderers of other sects are not thoroughbreds, we imagined that they are thoroughbreds. Okay, so the word thoroughbred here is Arjania. Okay, so this is a word used similar way that we use thoroughbred in English to mean a very fine horse. We imagine the thoroughbreds, though they're not thoroughbreds. We fed them the food of thoroughbreds. Okay, Arjania bhojanang bhojimha. Though they are not thoroughbreds, we set them in the place of thoroughbreds. Okay, Arjania tane. But though the bhikkhus are thoroughbreds, we imagine that they're not thoroughbreds. Though they are thoroughbreds, we fed them the food of those who are not thoroughbreds. Though they are thoroughbreds, we set them in the place of those who are not thoroughbreds. But now, Venerable Sir, as the wanderers of other sects are not thoroughbreds, we shall understand that they're not thoroughbreds. As they're not thoroughbreds, we shall feed them the food of those who are not thoroughbreds. Notice that he's the one saying this, the Buddha isn't saying that. And we shall set them in the place of those who are not thoroughbreds. But as the bhikkhus are thoroughbreds, and so on, he will feed them and place them in that way. Venerable Sir, the Blessed One has inspired in me a love for recluses, confidence in recluses, and a reverence for recluses. The samanesu samana pemang, pema, the love for. Samanesu samana pasadang, confidence. Samanesu samana garavang, reverence. Related to the word guru or garu, means the literally like the guruness. Magnificent, abhikantang, Master Gotama. This is another interesting difference here. Bhikkhu Bodhi's translated it as Master Gotama, and here he has Bhante, which seems more likely in the context, because in the previous line it says Bhante Bhagava, so that indicates that he's taken him as his teacher. And so on. Whereas you use Bahugotama is usually, and it is Brahman use, and it's usually someone who is a bit less respectful than saying Bhante and Bhagava. So it's different in the versions here. I don't know if it's mentioned. Could be a copy and paste thing.
Maybe it's a copy and paste.
Doesn't mention the different versions here. Okay, just as Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though turning upright would have been overturned, revealing what had been hidden, showing the way when it was lost, or opening up a lamp, holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus from today, let Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone to refuge for life. Okay.
Well, he was thoroughly won over.
And just to mention a couple of variations in the Chinese version mentions, after the final simile there, mentions the development of the four jhanas. So the Pali sort of skips all the way up to the fourth jhana, but the Chinese mentions all four jhanas. And the Chinese version goes straight from the four jhanas to the destruction of defilements and does not mention the first two of the higher knowledges, the first two of the Tevijja, that is recollection of past life and the divine eye, doesn't mention in the Chinese. And Majjhima Agama goes further and also says that Potalia actually attained stream entry at the end of the Buddha's discourse. So this again is quite typical that these stories of conversion and attainment during a discourse, generally speaking, vary a lot. So we've seen again, as so often, the body of the sutta, the actual content of the teaching is almost identical, and we have to go really scraping around to find one or two minor variations in formulation. On the other hand, the setting of the sutta is quite different. We've got a different town, a different place. And the story at the end of the attainment and conversion of the person who is given to is quite different. Okay? So this is quite a common feature. Okay.
But the funny thing is, in the end, he didn't end up giving up all of his.
Right. Yeah, but
What is sense of tongue?
What does what say? Chituttang. Where are we? Oh, Chituttang, the fourth. So this just means Potali Sutta, the fourth. So it's the fourth one in this particular chapter. Nirthitang, yeah, often they say Patai Sutta Nirthitang, yeah. That's the convention that they're using here, is just that's the only way in the manuscript that would be that these suttas would be counted. So the only way that you'd know that this is the fourth sutta would be that from that. It doesn't have page numbers and these kinds of things. What? Oh, no, just in this vagga, in this chapter, this is the only one that's got Patalia in it. Yeah, so it's just the fourth one in there.
Is Patalia mentioned anywhere else?
Patalia, I don't know. I can check, but I don't think so.
These sounds like the upper man with the walking stick. There seem to be a few of them through the sutta.
Uh-huh.
Sort of arrogant.
Yeah, it's got a bit of a stigma to it, doesn't it?
Is he using the proper name? Who's the one who did it again?
Malala Sikara.
He must have had a vast knowledge and spent vast
time
just reading and devouring and referring.
It's a great work of scholarship, but he was a politician and stuff. He was a Sri Lankan ambassador to Russia.
And he did this in his spare time, perhaps?
Yeah, I know. Some people have got brain space left over, I guess. You probably want to ask his wife what it was like.
Maybe she did it instead. Bhante, I enjoy feeding the wallaby and the bunnies and the birds.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sensual pleasure?
What do you think?
Well, I don't. I think sensual pleasure is supposed to be a sin.
A sin. Well, I think you maybe you've been your Catholic upbringing is hanging up is.
Well,
they asked us about this at the thing today, about Buddhism and sin and stuff, yeah.
Well, this whole sutta was saying sensual pleasure is a rotten thing.
But it's not. It's not the same as sin. Is a little bit different, though.
Yeah, forget the word sin. I just wanted to make myself clear.
That's good. Yeah.
So it's
feeding Wally is not a sin.
No, it's not. So it's not a bad sensual pleasure. Is it a sensual
pleasure? No. Rejoicing in doing good is not a sensual pleasure. It's part of the path to nirvana, not the path to.
Well, there we are. That makes it clearer.
But feeding Wally so that you can see him and he can become closer to you for your enjoyment.
Maybe.
Is.
Maybe, yeah.
Possibly. Or is essential pleasure.
Yeah, but maybe it's wanting to be closer so you can have more Buddhism.
It's possible, yes. Yeah. So you can try and convince yourself of that. there's another. I can't imagine so. Yeah. Certainly not on. Not unless you get off on seeing other people suffer. Yeah.
Suffer.
Having fishy pills stuff. A wanderer, there's Patalia the wanderer, he says, probably identical with this above. Had another conversation with the Buddha in the Anguttara Nikaya, at the end of which he declared himself the Buddha's follower. But it seems that in both of them he's declared himself the Buddha's follower, so that's a bit
odd.
One might investigate the different versions to see what the story is, whether it's the same person or not. But here, in one he's a Paribhajika, and the other one he's a householder.
Oh, in a sense, it's kind of like a Paribhajika.
Yeah, look, it could be the same person. It might just be a different person. It's a bit hard to say.
There's another sutta where the Buddha talks about, as a young man, he experienced the spectrum of pleasures to be experienced as a householder. And he experienced, did he use the word happiness? Of pleasure?
Yeah.
And then later on he experienced the pain of what was it? Was he referring to self-mortification?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then after that he went beyond pleasure and self-mortification.
Yeah.
So in that sutta, it's a very different approach that he has from this one. He refers to the happiness that one can attain from sensual pleasures.
Yeah.
So how would you reconcile that with what he's saying here?
Yeah, I mean, but he's not in here. He's not saying that sensual pleasures can't give you happiness. You know, the happiness that someone's had in the dream is a genuine happiness. You know, the happiness that someone had when he borrowed his bling and his wheels and showed them off was a genuine happiness. The happiness that the fellow had in the tree when he was eating the fruit was a genuine happiness. But the point is that it's only one-sided. So again, that's what he saw in the palace, is that these things also leads to aging and death and so on. Interesting, I was talking to somebody about that the other day, I think Julie, and she was saying that these days so many of the parents really raise their kids up not to experience any suffering. They can't stand having their children suffer anything. Yeah, and it's interesting, she mentioned like exactly the same example where I think some friends of theirs, the grandmother is dying, and the parents just won't tell the children, you know, so they're just trying to hide this kind of hide death away, exactly like Siddhartha's father, just really trying to hide it away, and can't stand that they know those things.
I think it's going to hit them even worse once.
Yeah, because then you not only have the problem of the death, you have the problem as well. Why are my parents so hung up about it? You know.
Well, that shows certainly that the Buddha didn't consider sensual pleasures a sin in any way. I mean, there was some happiness to be gotten.
And it's always, it's conditioned happiness, and it's always regarded as quite normal and quite appropriate that if you're, you know, if you want to, that's fine, you know, but you know, as long as you enjoy them in a way that's moderate, in a way that's you know, righteous, you haven't stolen them or, you know, extorted whatever you're getting, you know, and all of those kinds of things, then that's the appropriate rewards you get for living in this world, you know. So suffering's inherent in it, but you know, you understand that it has that limitation. It's always bound up with suffering, but you know, that's it. Yeah?
If a man goes to a place where the girls are undressing,
mm-hmm.
that's not a wholesome sensual pleasure.
Well, if he's gay, then it might be.
Well, he wouldn't go in there, would he, if he was gay?
He might just be in, like, you know, watching what, you know, the fashion or something like that, I don't know.
But then again, if they didn't have that, they wouldn't be in people.
If they didn't have dancing girls.
No, if they didn't have any sexual desire, there'd be no human beings.
Yeah, well, that's something we're really going to have to worry about right now. That's kind of, that's an urgent problem, isn't it? Yeah. Whoa, look out. Yeah, we've got so many arahants in the world these days, it's going to be a population crisis. Yeah. Okay, so...
It's only going to be the opposite when the water rises. So many people with nowhere hardly anywhere to go.
You
have to find somewhere else to go.
Okay. Yeah, I think the circumstances differ, you know, the particular angle that's chosen for a particular context, particular person. So
let's say in the mythical ones, you know, the Buddha talks about conquering all the worlds, and it's extremely externally based.
What do you mean, conquering all the worlds?
Well, when he's like trying to wrestle with Brahma and...
I can
go to this world, I can conquer this world. It's a very external kind of goal orientation. And then I know that it's supposed to be a metaphor for an internal.
Yeah.
That's what I've heard, probably from you. But so
that's certainly very dramatic, isn't it?
Yeah. So, but they're kind of all in degrees of that externality, aren't they? They have to be.
Well, they have to be. Yeah. It's not an EEG graph of the Buddha's brain or something like that. Yeah.
So the reflective process is still an external. Externalization.
You mean the way that the reflective process is described?
The reflective process, yeah. The way it's described reflective processes are external, you know, like if you had to think about externals and conditions that aren't present necessarily right now, that's an externalization.
Yeah, in one sense, yeah. That's fine.
In terms of sensual pleasures, in the first sutta, the Buddha talks about a path, the middle way, and he explains that as a path between the pursuit of sensual pleasures, which is what does he say? It's
vulgar, mean,
crude,
painful,
and producing pain.
Yeah.
And the other path, which is self mortification.
Yeah.
So it seems that he showed a middle way.
Right.
Here he's showing one aspect of it.
Mm.
But in that other sutta that I mentioned to you before, he's showing that sensual pleasures are not necessarily bad.
Mm.
So I think it's kind of up to us to find the middle way then. How do we do that?
Yeah, because I mean, like even it's quite common in the suttas that, you know, obviously to be a stream enterer, then you have to follow the middle way. But there's obviously stacks of lay stream enterers, so you know that doesn't require like a complete renunciation of sensuality and so on. But it does require, you know, first of all, a moderation, keeping precepts and all of those kinds of things with it. But, you know, moderation is all relative. I mean, there's examples of stream enterers who are, you know, there's one stream enterer who hires a prostitute to look after her husband while she goes off to the temple and these kinds of things. So there may be certain kinds of behaviour which we might regard as a little bit extreme, but
what a wise woman.
Yeah, that's what she did, yeah. Yeah.
What a wise woman.
They did. They had an argument afterwards, and the woman got so jealous she threw a pot of boiling oil at the wife. But she had such good metta that it just cooled down and didn't hurt her. Yeah. So that would be like if someone tried to throw it at you. I don't know why they would, but if they did, I'm sure that the oil would just.
The drunken stream
entry. The drunken. No, that's just a beat up. He's not really a drunken stream entry.
Yeah, pretty fine.
Sanghita.
Sanghita.
No, he's not drunken. He's not drunk. He's not a stream enterer when he's drunken. He's a drunkard beforehand and then becomes a stream enterer on his deathbed.
What about the one who puts out the hunter's tools for her husband?
Hunter's tools for the husband? I don't know that one.
Is that one?
No.
A wife who puts out. She's a stream enterer.
Oh.
And she puts out the hunter's tools for her husband.
It's in the Dhammapada.
Is it? I don't know. Sounds a bit odd. Yeah, there's all these kinds of things. It does talk about them, and then there's like what happens if you're the king and you're a stream enterer, and there's an invasion of your country. What do you do? You tell the generals, oh, there's an invasion on the borders of the country. Go and take the army and do as you see fit. Yeah.
Surrender to the white flag thing.
Yeah, but what if the invading army is going to then rape and pillage and murder everybody?
Oh, well, they come.
Just reduce it to faith.
Yeah, but it is. It's just irreducible that sometimes you can't make always the right decision.
Surely a stream enterer would not be put in a position where they have to lead an army to kill and slaughter.
I would hope so.
Isn't that the Bhagavad Gita?
Yeah, well, that's the Bhagavad. That's the theme of the Bhagavad Gita, isn't it? It'd make a great movie.
Slaughtering of the man.
It made a great litigation in the United States.
What, Bhagavad Gita?
Yes, there was there was a community called New Brindavan, which was based on something scriptural description of Brindavan in India. And this was, I believe, in West Virginia.
Mm.
And there was some kind of a competition between the teacher there and some other person. The teacher said, this is, of course, I'm telling you this secondhand. The teacher said, well, look, you know, I think we should do something about this other person. Mm. So, you know, the Bhagavad Gita says it's okay to kill your enemies. So you can do that, you know.
Wow. It's
spiritually justified.
Wow.
So he did it.
Mm.
And there was a homicide there. And then when the police investigated, you know, it came up. And I think the leader was put in jail for inciting his disciple to kill someone else based on the Bhagavad Gita.
Wow, that's pretty full on, isn't it?
Yeah.
Aham Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddham Bhagavantam Abhivadin Svakato Bhagavata Supatipanno Bhagavata.